Hello, America, and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host, Mr. Brandon Perkins. Joining as always is Chris Logie. Say goodbye to good people, Chris.
Hello.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to autumn. It's finally here. Summer is officially over. At least for a couple of days, and then asshole summer will show up next week. But then after that, it's autumn for real. And it's been just incredibly pleasant. It really has. Being able to go outside when it's only like 80 degrees is like, it feels like heaven. It really does. And, you know, it's going to like shoot back up to like 91 Monday down here. But after that, we get a little bit of rain and then it's back down to the 70s. So, yeah, I'm excited, genuinely. I know that sounds crazy, but when you're going through day after day of just, you know, swamp-ass hot weather and humidity, you're glad when it's finally over. But yeah, so anyway, this episode is going to be for September 23rd, 2023. But yeah, this week we will be discussing a few couple of things. We will be discussing a certain gentleman who founded a certain really popular music and cultural magazine, who recently released a new book and kind of revealed that he's kind of just revealed he's kind of a prick. We also have a police department that tased the director for a high school band, and we're going to tell you why. It's asinine. We also got some news about the now ongoing and potentially spreading United Auto Workers strike. And we've also got, you know, the usual political and entertainment shenanigans. We've got some trailers to talk about, some release dates. And Disney announced one of their famous Out of the Vault deluxe sets. We'll tell you what the price is, and we'll let you consider whether it's worth it or not. But, yeah, before we get to that and everything else, because we're going to have all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend, let's start, as we always do, with all the stuff we've been doing leading up to this week. So, Chris, as is tradition, you go first. What have you been doing?
I've been enjoying the weather.
Yeah.
For the most part, though, we had a little bit of a heat wave there. Mm-hmm. Into the upper 70s for a few days.
Yeah.
Which is not fun, but now we're back here in the like 70-ish range for the highs, so mm-hmm. It's nice cooler evenings and all that and mornings.
Oh, yeah.
Which is nice. To not have to have the sweat bath during the day is nice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been fun here, so yeah. For things I've been doing, watching more Columbo.
Yeah.
I'm in season 5 now.
Yeah.
Had Robert Vaughn kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an actor I know is a big name of that era.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 60s, 70s, 80s, but we probably most know him from being the bad guy in basketball.
Yeah.
where he's the bad team owner.
Yeah. Surprisingly, more than one people from that movie showing up in Columbo for some reason.
Yeah. So there's that. That's been fun. I did notice that they had a separate Columbo thing that ended up being one of the, I think they did two trial episodes.
Yeah.
Preview episodes. So this one's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the only one they have other than that's.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's called Columbo Prescription : Murder.
That's a very like prime time.
Like, yeah, it's from like 68, like a year or so before they started making them full time. And
yeah.
So you can tell because Columbo, it's still Peter Falk, but he has, you know, shorter, you know, clean hair,
yeah,
like a nice suit on, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Still smoking cigars and, you know, being the badgering investigator that he is elsewhere, but he's like not a, a slob of sorts. So yeah, that's like the big change they make when they go to the rest of it, but everything else, you know, writing and all that's largely the same.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a fun thing, but it's like a standalone thing on there for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the thing I don't like about Peacock, their setup is that they do not put times, like years or anything on the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So like I have to go to Wikipedia to figure out like, okay, what time frame is this in, kind of thing, to get a better sense of like when these actors are in their careers, where it's like Leonard Nimoy, it's like, oh, this is like right before he would do Star Trek and become too big for Columbo.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That kind of stuff. And yeah, it's like I'm on season 5. I'm like, is this like a year a season? Seems like, but they're, you know, they only airing like one a month for these episodes. So, because they're essentially doing like a TV thing where they're rotating with like three other series, essentially one like Saturday movie a week with other kind of mystery shows, stuff like that. And so, yeah, that was kind of the thing. So, yeah, I'm in season 5 now, that because seasons are only like six or eight episodes, so it's not too bad. But I know like the last season is like from maybe the 2000s. They did another string of episodes there, kind of thing. And I think there's another season. It's in the 80s, that kind of thing. So it's a lot of trying to figure out like, okay, when did they make all these seasons? Because it's 10 seasons. Yeah, the season 7's 77. So like right when Star Trek or Star Wars is getting big. And then they did 8 and 9 are both in, 89 to like early 1990 range. Then 10 is like 10 and like some specials. So like the first episodes there started in like late 1990. And then last one was in 2003. So like almost 30 years after the, or about 30 years after the first episodes there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a while to have like, he's still, I guess, some, you know, in homicide investigation, somehow never got promoted and out of this and making shit money, as he likes to talk about, because he has the same busted ass car.
Yeah.
That's falling apart constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's fun. Other thing I did is I watched all of the Fast and Furious series.
Yeah.
Because it's a series that I have not seen everything in it. I saw one when that came out. That was a big movie then.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't watch any other until 8.
Yeah.
8, 9, and 10 I watched in theaters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or 9 and 10 probably in theaters. 8 I might have gotten the Blu-ray. But
mm-hmm.
I was like, I want to see all the rest of this, because those movies are very much referential for bringing in these characters from the other ones. And it's like, I want to see how everything fits together in context, because you know, you don't understand why it's significant that, you know, this character returns and that kind of stuff. And it's like, all right, Fast and Furious still holds up.
Mm-hmm.
Too Fast, Too Furious, not good.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Vin and Michelle Rodriguez decided to nope out. And then it's just left Paul Walker and bring in Tej and Roman into the franchise. So that's like the notable thing there.
Yeah.
Three, which is Tokyo Drift, is a very dumb movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not very good as far as I'm concerned. It's, I can't get over the main character's like Texas accent.
Mm-hmm.
That is clearly not his natural accent.
Yeah.
He might even be like a British actor doing a Texas accent, which always goes well.
Mm.
Just look at Andrew Lincoln trying to do a Georgia accent.
Mm.
For that, but that ends with like, oh, Han dies and Vin Diesel shows up and is like, Han was my boy, we did work for years, and you're like, what? So that's kind of the way they bring Vin Diesel back into the series.
Mm.
And then they go to 4, which takes place, you know, after Too Fast, Too Furious, but before Tokyo Drift, and it's like, there's these movies here that are leading up to Tokyo Drift, as they somehow have a plan of sorts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the last series that you would ever expect any sort of planning of that sort. But yeah, four is like the start of their doing ridiculous spectacle stuff. Five is sort of the one that nails it when the Rock shows up in there, that kind of stuff. And yeah, everything else after that's very good and very ridiculous. And then you get like, oh, death doesn't mean anything in this series anymore. Because Letty is presumed dead, and then she comes back and lost her memory and somehow gets it back at a certain point. Who knows? But then Han was killed, and then nope. Or no, Han was killed, but he was killed by this other character, Deckard Shaw. But then you find out, nope, that was just a setup to by Mr. Nobody, Kurt Russell. Why not? You have Kurt Russell, you have Helen Mirren, you got Gal Gadot before she got big. Who else is in there? There's Brie Larson shows up in Fast 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they start bringing in bigger and bigger names and all that. And yeah, and it's up being pretty fun to kind of go through all this and like understand where a lot of this stuff goes and comes from. So yeah, pretty good stuff. Mm-hmm. Though the way you watch it right now is very weird.
Mm-hmm.
1 through 5 is on Netflix. Peacock has 5, 6, 7, 8, Hobbs and Shaw and 10.
Mm-hmm.
And 9 is on Freevee, which is the used to be IMDb TV,
mm-hmm.
But now it's like a free streaming service that essentially Amazon runs. That you can't watch any of that stuff on PC. You have to get an app on, you know, your phone or a console or whatever TV device you have, kind of thing, and it fills it with ads, like solid 3 to 4 minute ad breaks every so often, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of all over the place just to watch one series like that. But I guess that's because that's how you make more money off of this stuff, is you sell parts of it off to other services. Now, when they get to the certain point, they get on Peacock to watch the rest of it. So there you go. That was a fun little watch there, especially. Yeah. You see, like, tropes of, like, they love to catch falling people on the hoods of cars, where it's like that probably hurts like hell because it's just steel that can kind of crumple a little bit. But it's like a lot of these stunts with people landing on hoods of cars to save them from a nasty fall would probably kill them or do serious damage. But no, they're superhero people now. They'd only take serious damage when it matters in the storyline. That kind of stuff. You know, like when they find a way to suplex a big, not even, it's not a train, but it's essentially is a bunch of like super reinforced vehicles lined up, that kind of stuff, where it's like, all right, yeah. And that's like a real stunt they did. It wasn't CG. You read about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a fun series to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're not super understanding of how ridiculous it is.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when characters start talking about how weird it is that they go through all these ridiculous things and don't take any damage.
Yeah.
Despite their clothes being torn up and all this, and bullet holes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yeah, that's certainly a whole thing.
Mm.
But yeah, that's been what I've been watching this week. If we'd have been playing more Starfield, I put myself in a weird place where I stole a ship. I thought it was my ship and then went up and a bunch of pirates were around it.
Yeah.
So I killed them, went on board, and it's like, oh, you can, you know, kill everybody and take the ship if you want. And like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
I guess. The problem is they don't tell you anything about the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got on, The ship doesn't have many of the like crafting stations that the one they give you at the start of the game has.
Mm-hmm.
As well as I, you know, rebuilt that ship a bit to have more cargo in it. So that one I think could hold about 1,400 kilograms of cargo and this one could hold 200.
Mm.
So essentially, when I look at the inventory, like weight limit stuff, it's like, oh, you can hold, you have like 1199 of 200. I'm like, oh, I need my other ship. No, that's at a, you have to go to a, you know, a ship port somewhere, one of the main cities. And it's like, well, I got contraband, so I need to figure out what to do with that, or else I'm going to get arrested again. And so I think my solution is I'm going to go back to my house, take that contraband, just drop it in a room, and then leave. And then go to one of these ship stations and swap it out for the other one and just have that be the thing I stole from these pirates. It has like 3 dead bodies inside of it. I don't know how to get rid of them.
Mm.
I think there's supposed to be a way to like drop them out the airlocks or something, but I haven't figured that out, or the ship doesn't have that in it. It's like a thing that you can like shoot them out of the ship.
Mm.
I don't have anything like that. So that's where I'm at in Starfield, trying to figure that stuff out.
Yeah.
The other game I've been playing this on my Steam Deck, Super Mario RPG, kind of trying to get into it. And so far, doing all right. I've beaten a boss. I think it was a boss. It's a weird little T-Rex that steals a coin from Mallow, your first like buddy that you get in your party. That wasn't too bad, though I had to use a bunch of mushrooms because he does a lot of damage. I haven't tried to really do much grinding with my with Mario and Mallow, but I got through it just fine. Yeah, it's definitely a Mario RPG before they, you know, standardized a lot of features about it,
because
you can like jump around, but you don't get like any sort of surprise attacks on enemies by jumping on them before you, you know, when you go to attack them, that kind of thing. So you do anything to like seem like you're going to get like a sneak attack in there before the fight starts. It's not really a thing here. You just kind of have to run into them, and then you usually get the first attacks anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You just try and take out the tougher enemies as you can, but that kind of stuff. And the trying to get the right timing for extra attacks is not super great, especially for blocking them. That stuff's pretty tough, but for the most part, it's all right. For the for your attacks, it's not too bad. For trying to block attacks, it's a little bit tougher, especially as you run into enemies with different kinds of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they do kind of balance it out a little bit with enemies that when you do a lot of damage or kill them, they'll drop an item that like refills all your health or something like that, or gives you a boost in attack or something for the rest of the fight. So you can kind of get through and get extra health out of that stuff without having to, you know, constantly refill your stock of mushrooms and that kind of stuff. So it's not too bad. It's just a little, it's rough around the edges in ways that I'm not surprised, as Square and Nintendo are kind of trying to figure out how to make an RPG work for Mario before, you know, they did it themselves with Paper Mario and kind of nailed the kind of core aspects of the combat that you want, the exploration and all that. So, yeah, that's been pretty much it for me. So, Brandon, how have you been doing? What have you been playing?
Well, you're talking about Super Mario RPG just reminded me that there's that remake coming out. In, I think it's November? Yeah, 11/24, something like that. That game surprisingly does still hold up pretty well. And I think probably one of the great contributions that game made to gaming is it streamlined a lot of the sort of mechanics of turn-based RPGs that can be a little complicated for first-timers. Where they just, instead of like giving you like a list to go through, they actually like, attach the functions to like specific buttons on the controller, which is a lot easier to understand. But that game's great. I'm glad it's going to get some more love too. But anyway, Yeah, so I'm still playing Baldur's Gate 3. Like I said, I am in Act 3. I'm in Baldur's Gate itself. I recently managed to free Asterion from the guy who was his, you know, his maker, the chief vampire that made him. I originally had him go in there to do the battle with me, because, you know, it felt like something you'd want to do plot-wise. But the thing is, Asterion, if he's there, can be a bit of a hindrance, because the guy you're going up against will use his magic to basically trap Asterion, and then he will put him into a area where he will start draining the life from him to the point where if too many turns go by, it will kill him permanently and take you out of the party, take him out of the party. So not only do you have to deal with the fact that, you know, you have that over your head, but it also means you've essentially got a quarter of your party taken away from you when you need to fight this admittedly kind of tough boss and all the enemies that he has with us. Because remember, he's a vampire, and that means that he's got, you know, he's got ghouls, he's got bats, he's got, you know, werewolves and shit that'll try and kill you. It's a bunch of stuff. And of course, he himself, he has like this mist power where he can like turn himself into mist and then move away and then stay in that mist form for a turn, so it makes it harder to hit him. And he's got a pretty hefty, like, you know, energy meter. So, you know, so instead what I did is I just, you know, left Asterion back at the, I guess call it the camp, but it's not really a camp at this point. What I managed to do is I got to one of the major, like, taverns in Baldur's Gate in the lower city. I managed to convince the guy who runs it to let me have the suites at the top of the building. So now I have what used to be considered, quote-unquote, outdoor camp. I now have, you know, my party and everybody staying at this suite at the top of it with beds and, you know, a fireplace and all that stuff. And fortunately now, also, I don't have to constantly go looking for, you know, a supply pack. Because now I can just go over to the dumbwaiter that's in that little area and buy it, you know, completely. And it's like 20 gold? It's very cheap. So, yeah. But, yeah, so I did that. Now I'm in the process of trying to save Will's father. For those who don't know in the game, Will is this guy who's like his class is as a warlock, and he is a hero, but he's a hero who got his heroic powers by making a deal with a demon named Mizora. And Mizora has basically been controlling him for the better part of a decade. And, now that, you know, the Cult of the Absolute has sort of made their home in Baldur's Gate and is trying to sort of subterfuge their way to a war, Will's dad happens to be one of the major people in Baldur's Gate, and he's also come under the influence of the cult. Now, Zora makes this deal with you soon after you settle in the city. It's like she'll, you know, protect his dad, but, you know, he'll have to take Will to Avernus with her. But he could also break the contract and free him, but he would also almost assuredly kill his father. Catch is, it only basically seals his father's fate if you have no idea where he is. I actually found out where he is, and I'm on my way, you know, the last time I was playing, I was on my way over there to go and save him. But, yeah, I'm trying to, like, wrap up a bunch of these sort of sub-quests and stuff related to my party, because they all, you know, this is the final third of the game, and you want to wrap all that stuff up before you bring it to an end. But also because, again, you're in Baldur's Gate itself. It's a big city, and there's a lot of stuff you can do in it. And there's a lot of different plot lines and stuff that can be done. Again, I am continually amazed at just how much variety and just content that Larian Studios managed to shove into this game without having to add any DLC or you know, expansions or microtransactions or anything like that. Honestly, if they decide that, hey, we're going to make an expansion, I will buy it up like that, because they've basically proven how good they are, how amazing what this game is. But, other than that, I've been doing my usual with, the reading and all that stuff. Like I said, I'm still reading For Want of a Nail. And I finished the chapter where they talked about the so-called wilderness walk, where they're all, the surviving revolutionaries are making their way to the area that will eventually become the state of Jefferson and will become the sort of heart for what will become the United States of Mexico. And it's really kind of neat how deeply he comes into it's just sort of like not just the concept of like what, not just like how this changes history, but also how it changes politics. People who know, how early American history was after, the revolution was successful, you ended up, and after, George Washington became president and then resigned after his second term, sort of setting that precedent. That was when, like, the first political party started to come into existence in the United States. The first two major political parties, which were Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. And if you're a Hamilton fan, you might remember sort of how these two groups sort of came about. The Federalists were largely based around, more about a stronger central government that could take part in, protectionism and stuff like that, and it was largely, based around people like Hamilton and John Adams. Then he had the Democratic Republicans, which was people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And they favored more decentralized free trade type stuff, and also slavery, but that was another thing. Here, what happens is, after the United States of Mexico is founded, they end up having two political parties, much like here, that ended up becoming major. One is called the Liberty Party, and they are ideologically heavily based around the ideals of the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. They tended to oppose slavery. They also opposed the expansionism. And then there's the Continentalist Party, which ends up sort of becoming the dominant political party for a lot of USM history. The Continentalists basically said that, that was the ideology of the old world. They were in a new land now, founding a new country, and it was time for a newer ideology. And Continentalism was basically, its basic sort of platform was that the new United States of Mexico had to extend all the way west and then both north and south to all the parts of North America that was not owned by the Confederation of North America, which, amongst other things, meant that they ended up reintroducing slavery into parts of Mexico where it had, in fact, been abolished for about 20 years. it's a really fascinating book. I'm not saying that it's necessarily a scintillating page turner, because again, it's written very much like an undergrad textbook, but it's still incredibly engaging reading. And just sort of the alternate world that Robert Sobel slowly builds with this book is pretty fascinating. Other than that, it's just, the fact that autumn is here. Yeah, it's here. We have autumn. Hooray. I don't have to, I can walk down to the mailbox and not, die from, not sweat to death on my way down. But so do you have anything you want to add, Chris, before we move on?
Nope.
No. Okay. So alrighty then, well then it's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Rant Effectual. And in recent, I would say recent years, but more in like in the last year or so, the subject of banned books have sort of become a big topic. For numerous reasons, there's parents groups, or well, really a specific parent group, we will remain nameless for now, who are trying to basically get anything that they don't like restricted from children in school libraries. Anything that has the hint of anything vaguely gay or sexual, or even something that's about, you know, racism, they will want to get rid of it. And I'm pretty sure most of these people have never actually read any of these books. We don't have it on here. Recently, there was a school teacher that was terminated from their position because they assigned a illustrated version of Anne Frank's Diary of a Young Girl. But yeah, so it brings up the subject of like book banning. The idea of banning books, of repressing books, of keeping books away from the general populace, you know, the basic ethics and morality of doing such a thing. Are there such books that are so dangerous that they need to be kept away from, you know, regular people because they may possibly inspire something terrible? Now, there are two books that are generally considered to be the most dangerous books that have ever been published. One of them is very recent. It's only been around since the early 70s. And the other one is probably the book you're absolutely thinking of. We'll talk about that first book real quick. So that first book, you may have heard the name. You may have no idea actually in it or what it talks about. It's a little book that was published in 1971 called The Anarchist Cookbook. Have you ever heard that title, Chris?
Yeah.
Okay. So The Anarchist Cookbook is this book that was published in 1971. It was written by a guy who, at the time, he was a 19-year-old guy. His name was William Powell. Now, you have to kind of understand where America was in 1971. This was during the apex of the counterculture era. The Vietnam War was still raging on. It was arguably in its deadliest years. Nixon was now president, which meant that no one was really sure if the war was ever going to end. Political violence and terrorism was going on the upsurge, especially in the United States. There was a bunch of radical political groups going around doing bombings and kidnappings and all kinds of stuff. This was also like a year after the Kent State shooting, where a bunch of National Guardsmen opened fire on a group of student protesters. So let's just say, Arrow was kind of fraught at the time, and William Powell sort of fancied himself a young revolutionary. And so what he did is he compiled this book that was made up of materials for the manufacture of explosives, telecommunications devices, rudimentary improvised weapons, the home manufacture of illicit drugs, including hallucinogens, stuff like that. Now, again, this was when he had published the book in 1971. He was 19. A few years later, in 1976, he converted to Anglican, i.e. he became an Episcopal or Church of England, whatever you want to call it. And for years afterward, pretty much the rest of his life, he did everything he possibly could to try and get this book taken out of print. Not necessarily because of political reasons, but because of safety reasons. Again, he wrote this thing when he was 19, meaning that he ended up filling this thing with a bunch of incorrect and dangerous information. People lost fingers. They lost pieces of their faces. They lost limbs. They suffered severe mental and psychological damage. They were poisoned. They blew themselves up. And the problem was he could never get it taken out because the copyright belonged to the publisher. And they kept circulating and publishing this book. It went through several printings, and they kept publishing it well in the 1991 because the mystique that this book got meant it got a bunch of copies. It sold like crazy through the entire time it was published. But But the thing is, pretty much even the last editions, if you find them, still contain very incorrect information that, if you follow them, could risk life and limb to them. So this is an example of like a book that is, you could say, is dangerous, but not necessarily because of ideas, but because it gives off a sort of false degree of information that could actually hurt you. There's actually, in Estonia, there's actually a banned book museum, and they actually have one copy of this book at that premises, and the guy who runs the museum actually keeps it behind the counter and only brings it out if people ask for it, because he's like, yeah, I'm against censorship and banning books, but this one takes me to my absolute limit, because it legitimately, you know, has, it is like a legitimate threat to public safety. So there's that. But then there's the other book that we all think of when we think of dangerous books. Chris, I'm going to give you three guesses. What book do you think it is?
I don't know.
Let's say the guy wrote a little book, fired people up, then took over the country, and then murdered millions of Jews.
Oh, Mein Kampf?
Yes, Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf is an interesting edition. It is generally considered the most dangerous book of the 20th century for fairly good reason. I mean, the guy inspired a movement that in turn committed what's considered the most horrifying genocide of the 20th century. And by horrifying, I don't mean necessarily just by numbers, but by method. The Holocaust was the first genocide in history wherein it was industrialized, an industry was built, infrastructure was made, a bureaucracy was created. All of this to systematically murder millions upon millions of men, women, and children. So as you can imagine, after World War II ended, people were kind of a little edgy about letting this book out into the wild again. So here's the funny thing. Germany famously is very restrictive when it comes to Nazi stuff, and for very good reason, as you can probably guess. But believe it or not, Germany never actually formally banned Mein Kampf from publication or circulation. And there is a reason for that. See, after Hitler killed himself in 1945, the copyright of the book went over to the state government of Bavaria. And Bavaria, up until 2016, the state government of Bavaria refused to publish or let anyone copy any form of the book into German. The only reason you can now get a German version of it now is because in 2016, it finally entered into the public domain. Now, in modern German, in modern Germany, there is only one version you can get of the copy of the book that you can actually get legally. It's a very unadorned, very, you know, plain looking, very large annotated hardcover. It's basically like the size of like a scrapbook, basically. Very large. It has the complete text, and then inside of it on the margins there are various annotations and pieces of information to sort of let you know what, you know, what Hitler is referring to in specific parts, where he's lying, where to show contradictory information, where he is just making stuff up out of thin air. And also kind of keep your attention, because the thing is, Mein Kampf, as not just because of the horrible message and what it unleashed upon the world, it just kind of sucks as a book. See, the thing is, we say that this book was written by Adolf Hitler. It was via notate, by a dictation. He didn't actually write the book, the manuscript himself. He actually dictated, no pun intended, to a sympathetic priest while he was in prison after the beer hall pushed. And that is what eventually became Mein Kampf. When that book was released, you were essentially seeing a book. And originally when it came out, sell all that well. It didn't become really a bestseller until years later after Hitler's rise to power. And then eventually it got to the point where the Nazi state would just mass produce them and give them out as like gifts. So this also, it brings up another interesting idea. It's like, how can you have like a liberal democratic state that respects the idea of freedom of speech, even for stuff you disagree with, and then you have something like this book that is so, that has indirectly caused so much hardship and bloodshed? Well, you have it basically have somebody, in this case a state government, buy up the copyright and just not publish it anymore. And, you know, sue anybody who tries to copy it or break that copyright. But there's a flip side to that, because one of the things about doing that is that it gives a book a mystique. It makes it dangerous in the public mind, and people are drawn to things that have that dangerous mystique to them. Part of the reason that the German government finally allowed for that heavily annotated version to go into circulation was to break that mystique. Because remember I said, this book, the book isn't very well written. It's very rambly. It goes off places. Hitler constantly complains and repeats himself on the same subject for countless pages. And part of the thing about that edition of the book going back into print is it shows people that, wow, this guy really was kind of full of shit, wasn't he? Because that's really what Mein Kampf is. It's basically a giant shit post from some guy who can't accept the fact that he's at fault for most of his own problems. I mentioned that guy who runs the banned book museum in Estonia. Unlike the Anarchist Cookbook, he has three copies of that particular edition I just talked about out in the open for anybody to pick up and flip through, because he believes that if you can take the mystique and get somebody actually trying to read it, you'll find out that, you know, the more of the sort of cult that grew up around the book is mostly based around bullshit, and that the actual book is really underwhelming and it won't really convince a lot of people of anything. But you know, that's their decision to make. Really. So yeah, that's kind of a sort of a little thing to talk about. I wanted to talk about sort of those two instances of books that are either banned or attempted to be banned for two different reasons, and how people go about it. And yeah, that's been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. All right, so with that, we're now moving on to the show proper. We start off with our Assholes of the Week. And our first Assholes of the Week are Jan Winter, founder of Rolling Stone magazine. He is being criticized over his new book not featuring black and female musicians because they, quote, weren't articulate enough.
Yeah, it's not a great thing to say when you're, you know, a founder of Rolling Stone magazine that's pushed for a lot of talent over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, use this bad language here. Had to apologize for it here in my interview with the New York Times. I make comments that diminish the contributions, genius, and impact of black and women artists, and I apologize wholeheartedly for those remarks. Like I said, the interviews in the book were not meant to represent the whole of music and its diverse and important originators, but rather to reflect the high points of his career.
Yeah.
And sort of about seven interviews with rock and roll icons that are all just white male dudes. You know, big names at that. Mm-hmm. Bob Dylan, John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and others. But yeah, the interviewer here asked Winter why no similarly famous female or black rockers such as Janis Joplin or Stevie Wonder made the cut. He said the men he interviewed were kind of philosophers of rock, that no female musicians were as articulate enough on this intellectual level as the men. It's not that they're inarticulate, though, although go have a deep conversation with Grace Slick or Janis Joplin, please be my guest. You know, Joni Mitchell was not a philosopher of rock and roll. She didn't, in my mind, meet that test. Not by her work, not by other interviews she did. And it's like, oh, wow. Thing to say there. Also, did the same for black artists. Of black artists, you know, Stevie Wonder, genius, right? I suppose when you use the word as broad as masters, the fault is using that word. Maybe Marvin Gaye or Curtis Mayfield. I mean, they just didn't articulate at that level. That's like, oof. Yeah, you know, and he also says here, let's see, you know, just for public relations sake, maybe I should have gone and found one black and one woman artist to include here that didn't measure up to the same historical standard just to avert this kind of criticism, which I get it. I had a chance to do that. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. I don't give an expletive or whatever. I wish in retrospect I could have interviewed Marvin Gaye. Maybe he'd have been the guy. Maybe Otis Redding, had he lived, would have been that guy. And it's like, man, that's only something you could say, I guess. But does not...
Digging that hole deeper, really.
Yeah. And I guess as a response to this, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame removed him from their board of directors for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation. So there's something.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, so...
Yeesh.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Good Lord.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah, that was just... Damn. It's like, at some point, it's like... stop talking. Yeah. I'm just making this worse.
Yeah, especially as you're using terms like philosophers of rock and roll, which I don't know what that is. It's not like a common term or anything. It's just like,
yeah,
it seems like just a made up sort of tier of performer that you use to justify this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. But moving on from there, we got these assholes. Members of the Birmingham Police Department who tased the director of a high school band for not stopping his band's performance after a football game. Yes, this actually happened.
Yeah. We had a routine band performance of Talking Out the Side of Your Neck by Cameo at an Alabama high school game.
Mm-hmm.
Ended with a troubling confrontation when a police officer asked them to stop, and he was saying, like, we're on our last song, just let us finish. But took that as a sign of, you know, refusing to do anything, you know, to do what he said. So pulled out a taser and shot him with it.
Yep.
It occurred Thursday around 9 p.m. local time after a game at Jackson Olin High School in Birmingham, Alabama. Johnny Mims is the band director, and his ensemble of 145 students were about a minute away from being done with their final song when a police officer approached the podium. According to both Mims and the police department, officers asked Mims to stop the performance so they could clear out the stadium. Mims responded that the song was about to end and the performance was agreed on by both schools. Nothing we were doing at the time was being a danger to the community, fans, or the school. Mims said, everyone was enjoying themselves. That's the part I'm having a hard time grappling with.
Yeah.
As students finished their performance, officers attempted to arrest Mims for not complying. Police said the band director refused to place his hands behind his back and allegedly pushed an arresting officer. Mims said he was simply caught off guard, adding that it was difficult to see who was grabbing him because the stadium's lights went out. Moments later, an officer pulled out a stun gun and tased Mims. They said it happened once, but Mims insists he was tased up to 3 times. And yeah, the entire confrontation witnessed by dozens of students, parents, and faculty members. And yeah, they released the camera footage of the incident. So yeah, he had to go to the hospital, which I guess is standard protocol after getting tased. When he was discharged, he was taken to jail on charges of disorderly conduct, harassment, and resisting arrest.
Yeah.
Which seems like ridiculous for this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we'll see how this goes in the future.
Mm-hmm.
See if anything comes of it. I assume they'll just drop the charges and move on because it makes them look stupid and ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But moving on from there, we got another asshole of the week, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. It was discovered this week that he has close ties to the Koch Network that had him speak at two fundraising events for the organization. Originally founded by the Koch brothers, now brother, because one of them died. But, yeah.
Yeah, one of the largest, most influential political organizations in the country.
Mm-hmm.
That the justice, on at least two occasions, spoke at fundraising events for them. Yeah, he'd at least twice been brought in to speak at private dinners for large donors to the Koch Network. I put him what ProPublica called the extraordinary position, having served as a fundraising draw for a network that has repeatedly brought cases before the Supreme Court. And yeah, let's see, in 2021, one of the Koch entities, Americans for Prosperity, successfully challenged state laws that required nonprofits to disclose the identity of their large donors. This year, the network is supporting a challenge to a longstanding Supreme Court regulatory precedent that he did not recuse himself from the 2021 case, nor does it seem like he's going to do from the one coming up here. So it just kind of shows there's more and more of his repeated corruption that continues to unfurl as, you know, people like ProPublica continue digging into the mess that is his history.
Yep.
With this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, so... And finally, we got this one. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez has been indicted on federal corruption charges. Apparently they found like a crap ton of money hidden away in his house or something. Like some gold bars, too.
Yeah. And his wife have been charged. Basically, everybody of note is calling on him to resign, but he has said he is not going to do that.
Yeah.
Let's see here. The indictment accuses Menendez and his wife of engaging in a corrupt relationship with three New Jersey associates and businessmen. Let's see. And accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars of bribes in exchange for using the senator's power and influence over a years-long relationship.
Yeah.
They received bribes that included cash, gold bars, payments towards a home mortgage, compensation for a low or no-show job, luxury vehicle, and other things of value, the indictment claims. In a search of the pair's home, prosecutors said they uncovered several high-value gold bars and more than $480,000 in cash, much of it stuffed into envelopes hidden inside jackets bearing Menendez's name. Which is like, how many fucking jackets do you have to hide all these envelopes in? As well as, gold bars are not a thing that's like normally exchanged.
No, if you have gold bars, you usually have them locked away in a safe somewhere.
Yeah, not like in a closet or something.
Yeah.
That's like a thing you take to the bank and stick it in one of their
safety deposit boxes or something like that.
Especially, they probably have special ones for that kind of stuff. But yeah, the senator said Friday that prosecutors misrepresented the normal work of a congressional office. He continued, on top of that, not content with making false claims against me, they have attacked my wife for longstanding friendship she had before she and I even met. Those behind this campaign simply cannot accept that a first-generation Latino-American from humble beginnings could rise to be a U.S. senator and serve with honor and distinction. Even worse, they see me as an obstacle in the way of their broader political goals. Which is a very Trump thing to say.
Yeah.
So, congratulations.
That was some bullshit.
Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, the governor of New Jersey has acknowledged that he has not been tried or found guilty, but called the charges too egregious to ignore, suggesting that he should be resigning. You got, you know, the state Democratic Party chair, Leroy Jones Jr., urging him to resign. You got New Jersey Rep. Andy Kim saying on Saturday that he would challenge Menendez for his Senate seat in 2024. As well as many other involved in the area and in the state, sort of suggesting that he should be forced to resign. Especially comparing him to George Santos.
Yeah.
Especially apparently giving out information and such to Egypt. That puts you into traitor territory right there.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I guess you could, because, I mean, technically we're on friendly terms with Egypt, so if he was doing it with, like, say, Iran, then, yeah, that would be a different story.
I don't know. I think there's sensitive government information. Is like,
oh, yeah, probably.
You probably need to be going through surrogate or, you know, through other processes versus giving that out on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. So, fortunately, it's not all terrible. We actually do have some heroes of the week to discuss. First and foremost, the Senate managed to promote General Charles Q. Brown to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they did it by somehow managing to get around Tommy Tuchel's blocking of promotions.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was a good move. So now we have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
To get past his months-long hold on nominees, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer forced a full Senate vote on Brown, who was confirmed on Wednesday evening, 83-11. Mm. Chamber voted Thursday on two more military nominations.
Mm-hmm.
Brown's confirmation comes just days before the outgoing chairman, Army General Mark Milley, is required to step down after 4 years in the post. Brown's elevation also comes at a crucial moment in the war in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Volodymyr Zelensky has been visiting with the representatives in Congress and all that. He was trying to set up a speech for the House, and McCarthy shot him down on that. Now I think he's in Canada talking to people up there for that. So, yeah, great news. We got a new Joint Chiefs of Staff just days before there's going to be nobody in that role. Yeah, they also confirmed the nomination of General Randy George to be Chief of Staff of the Army by a vote of 96-1, and later by a 96-0 vote, General Eric Smith to be Commandant of the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Who's that fucking one guy? Is that Tommy?
It might be.
But yeah, it doesn't solve the larger problem of all these others getting blocked through this. So we need to see them keep doing this. But this is probably drawing it out much longer than a normal process would do for this.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, so then we've also got this. The federal government free mail order COVID test program starting on Monday. So yeah, starting Monday, you will be able to get another get these free tests because we're fixing to have another round. We know we are, and we're planning for it.
Yeah. Up to four free rapid tests for any household that requests them.
Yep.
No reason not to. They're already essentially paid for with your taxes. So, yeah, you'll just have to visit the USPS website. They also recommend not just throwing out any unused tests you got from the last round. There's a website for that, covidtest.gov, to check the lots you have for expiration dates, because they've extended some of them for that stuff. So, yeah, definitely well worth checking out. Yeah, starting September 25th for that. So, great news there.
Yeah. All right. And finally, the Biden administration has announced plans for new regulations to bar medical debt from affecting credit scores.
Yeah. That's great. Now, the regulations, if enacted, would potentially help tens of millions of people who have medical debt on their credit reports, eliminating information that can depress consumer scores and make it harder for many to get a job, rent an apartment, or secure a car loan.
Yeah.
They would also represent one of the most significant federal actions to tackle medical debt, a problem that burdens about 100 million people and forces legions to take on extra work, give up their homes, and ration food and other essentials.
Yeah.
100 million people is a lot in a country of 370 million.
It's like a third of the population.
Yeah, like 30%.
Yikes. But yeah, so, but anyway, yeah, that was the show proper. We're now moving on to the proper show proper. And our first story of the night is that this week, Rupert Murdoch announced that he has stepped down as chair of both Fox and News Corp, letting his son Lachlan lead all of it.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily the cause for celebration. Some people make it out as, because Lachlan is arguably a bigger asshole than Rupert Murdoch, but he probably doesn't really have as much of his dad's business sense either.
Yeah,
but yeah, it could be the beginning of the end, and it could not be.
He probably has less of a desire to cover up people's, you know, harassment and abuses that mm-hmm. Rupert had for Fox News,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, those people were doing things for years before they eventually were forced to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine that kind of stuff is a plus in his column, but that's not saying much.
Mm-hmm.
That's a baseline thing. But it's also that Rupert's 92.
Yeah, he's old as dirt.
Yeah, so that's probably more of just having, you know, a succession plan there for that. So
mm-hmm.
really nothing else to add here. Just
yeah,
one old fuck gave it to a less old fuck.
Yeah, like the damage has already been done, right? It's not going to necessarily solve anything. Next up, Chuck Schumer has officially relaxed the dress code for the Senate in the, let's be honest, dumb controversy latest in Congress. Let's be frank here. The reason they did this dress code was because the owning classes convinced people that work clothes were somehow low class.
Yeah. Yeah, and it adds a bar of financial requirements for being in Congress.
Yep.
Because, you know, a lot of people come from some money mm-hmm. in Congress, but there's a lot of people that don't. Mm-hmm. As like AOC has talked about, how much of a you know, burden it was to have the required wardrobe to mm-hmm. be in the House reps.
Yep.
All that stuff. And yeah, John Fetterman's been the latest. Is a dude is large, tall and large, who getting, you know, a suite of suits for that to do his.
He's like over 6 feet tall, isn't he?
He's like 6'7", 6'8",
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, he's tall. That is not an insubstantial height. He is a very, very big man.
Yeah.
And trying to find clothes for someone that size can be a hassle.
Yeah. Because, yeah, they're not paid super well for this work.
No.
For that, but, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, dressed most days of the week. I'm not going to say every day, because they routinely, like, the House ended their week on Thursday at, like, mm-hmm. 3:00. While they're still fucking around trying to get a funding bill passed, that kind of stuff. And of course, you got all the weirdos like Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeting that the Senate no longer enforcing a dress code for senators to appease Fetterman is disgraceful.
Have you seen what she wears when she goes there? She does not, is not the talk.
And Fetterman has been on top of replying to this stuff, saying, mm-hmm. thankfully, the nation's lower chamber lives by a higher code of conduct, displaying ding-a-ling pics in public hearings.
Mm-hmm.
He's also called people jag-offs for talking shit about his dress code when he's not even going to be on the floor.
As is his right.
Yeah. And it's like, we need more people calling, you know, the other people in Congress jag-offs when they're being idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll convince them not to be jag-offs. Joe Manchin has been, you know, puffing up his britches for this, you know, being like, mm-hmm. oh, I believe these changes are wrong, and talking to Fetterman about this, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. Good for you, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just a Susan Collins joked that she planned to wear a bikini on the Senate floor, and it's like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
And they Rand Paul is like sitting in a robe out on the steps, and it's like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
This is the entirely dumb thing you would do. So, okay. It's a nothing story.
Yeah.
It's like, I doubt he's going to go in there and, like, you know, sweatpants and, you know, real cheap stuff. But, you know, he doesn't really need to wear suits and ties to walk around the halls to his office on the days where he's not going to be in the chamber.
Yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, there you go. That's your dumb controversy, as more important things are supposed to be going on in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway. Oh, there was that bullshit. Next up, the Southern Baptist Convention has officially ousted an Oklahoma church whose priest did blackface.
Yeah.
This is a hell of a story.
Yeah. Oklahoma church whose pastor defended his blackface performance at one church event and his impersonation of a Native American woman at another.
Uh-huh.
So double offense there. Let's see. Sherman Jacques dressed in blackface for a 2017 church Valentine's Day event. So not like this was 20 years ago. Nope. This was 6 years ago for Valentine's Day, which he claimed to be impersonating the late soul singer Ray Charles. You know how easy it is to impersonate Ray Charles? You get on a piano bench, you put on sunglasses, and you swing your head around.
Yeah, that's all you got to do. It's that simple.
Everybody gets it at that point. But instead he wore dark facial makeup, a large afro wig, and dark glasses.
Which I'm pretty sure that even Ray Charles never had an afro.
Yeah.
He always kept his hair cut pretty close.
Yeah, he was fairly short hair for the most part.
Well,
I'm sure he had it long at some points, but maybe not while he was super famous. But yeah. Let's see. It was brought to light earlier this year by a Tulsa community activist, so that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Another Facebook photo published by Examiner Enterprise of Bartlesville also surfaced, showing him dressed as a Native American woman at a Cowboys and Indians night at a church camp. Photo shows a man dressed as a cowboy holding an apparently fake gun to Jacques in jest, while a boy dressed as a cowboy is poised with raised fists next to him. It's weird to see anything named Cowboys and Indians in this day and age. I think that's a thing of our childhood, but that would just be, you know, cowboys and Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Also doing cowboys and Native Americans, like, okay, not a great thing, but this is Oklahoma, so I grant them that is a thing they're probably brought up on big time versus, like, you and I, where it's like, you're dealing with stuff in the South, we're dealing with snow, we don't really care too much about that stuff outside of the kids stuff they do. But yeah, it's whatever.
Yeah.
Also, he claimed in a sermon that he has Cherokee blood in blood in me, but I put some brown makeup on. I was trying to look like a Native American woman.
It's like, yeah, you can stop there.
Yeah, it's like, okay.
Mm.
But this was enough for the Southern Baptist churches to vote him out. So, at least out of their membership, they can still do whatever they want as part of that, you know, denomination. So, they're independent, so they can do whatever. But they don't have to be part of the leadership or anything. So, there you go.
Yep. But yeah. So, next up, if you've been to the grocery store, you may have noticed that it's been a little more difficult than usual to get anything related to Clorox, whether it be Clorox bleach or Pine Sol or Brita, you know, Burt's Bees, that type of stuff. Well, there's a reason for that. There's a bit of a shortage of Clorox products right now because they suffered a cyber attack back in August.
Yeah. Yeah, they announced on August 14th it identified unusual activity on its IT systems, later confirming it had been the victim of a hack. Disrupted Clorox's system so much that the company had to start processing orders manually, though it now says it expects to transition back to automated order processing next week. And so they resumed production at the vast majority of its manufacturing facilities, and that it's continuing to repair the damaged parts of its IT infrastructure. Saying that it'll hurt their earnings for the quarter, but doesn't yet know how it'll impact their finances in the long run. But yeah, kind of a weird thing to see, but yeah, disrupted things for a month or so there. So you'll be able to get your stuff as soon as you can. Mm-hmm. Also, there's other brands, so you can just go to them for now. So there you go.
Yeah. So yeah, that's happening. And now, a little story that's just, honestly, I think is kind of funny. A Danish artist has been ordered to repay a museum after delivering two blank canvases. The reason I think this is hilarious is because anybody who's done any research on the quote-unquote art world knows that it's basically one giant scam. And this is just kind of funny.
This guy signed a deal getting a loan of 532,549 Danish krone, equivalent of about $76,400 from the Kunsten Museum of Modern Arts in Aalborg. And yeah, submitted in response to blank canvases titled "Take the Money and Run."
Yep. See?
Yeah. The money was to be used to recreate two earlier works by Hanning that depicted in actual cold hard cash affixed to canvas in a frame. The average annual income of a Dane and an Austrian and the sizable gap between them, reflecting wage differences within the European Union. Now, Hanning has been ordered by Copenhagen Court to repay most of the money, approximately about $70,600, as well as the equivalent of an additional $11,000 in legal fees. So, yeah. Saying, I am shocked, but at the same time, it is exactly what I have imagined. So, yeah, and the museum is basically like, we're not a wealthy museum. This is a lot of money. To spend on this kind of thing, and this is not exactly what we wanted in return. So, yeah. There you go. Fun little weird story.
Yeah.
Bad news for the artist for trying to pull this, but...
Yeah. And now we're going into the entertainment portion of the show. Drew Barrymore finally did the right thing and delayed her show's return until the strikes are over. Speaking of which, by the way, the might be over by the end of this weekend.
Maybe.
It was announced this week today that they are apparently with the legal people hammering out the language for the 3-year contract that everyone is getting ready to sign, and that might be the end of it. Of course, that doesn't end the SAG-AFTRA strike, but...
Yeah. And none of it really matters until, you know, the WGA announces that they have accepted the, the tentative agreement and have, you know, their members vote for it. So that's the thing. Like, don't take it as a sign like, oh, it's pretty much done. But luckily for Drew Barrymore, she may not have to wait too much longer for this part of it. As she got a lot of criticism for taping new episodes of her daytime talk show despite the ongoing writers and actors strike. So now she's going to wait till those are over. And yeah, the talk on CBS also did the same thing. So yeah, good news. Shouldn't have really gotten this far either way. I want to say Bill Maher did the same thing, but nobody gives a shit about him, so.
And next we got some music news. Blink 182 has announced their new album, One More Time, will be out October 20th.
Yeah. Great news. They put out the first single from it, which is also titled One More Time. Featuring the three, you know, back together again, playing music. talking about, not, holding grudges anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Mark and Travis definitely did when they first broke up.
Yeah.
Talking about, it shouldn't take, an illness or planes falling out of the sky to get you to get back together with the people you love.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. So it's a very nice song, especially the music video if you watch it, because they kind of go through a bunch of backgrounds of various mm-hmm. other videos they've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. Which is a fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially seeing how far CG has come for this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they're clearly in a green screen, but going through, the big airplane hangar from the one song and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to this album.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go.
So yeah, it's all three of the original members back together. So
maybe not the original. There's they made a change with Travis in there versus one of the previous drummer.
Oh, right. Well, the two guys people actually care about. Let's put that way.
Well, the three when they got big.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's awesome. Next up, Disney announced a $1,500 set of 100 Disney and Pixar movies for their 100th anniversary.
Yeah. Blu-ray collection called the Disney Legacy Animated Film Collection.
Mm-hmm.
$1,499.96. Releases November 14th. Pre-orders are available now at Walmart mm-hmm. exclusively. Let's see. It's packaged as a 3-volume set featuring animated films from Disney, Walt Disney Animation, and Pixar. But yeah, this isn't filled with direct-to-video stuff. At least not much of it.
Mm.
But includes a lot of your classics and such, and even stuff I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Like starts with Snow White and Pinocchio, Fantasia, Dumbo, Bambi.
Mm-hmm.
And gets Saludos Amigos, which I don't know.
Yeah, I think I remember that one.
And then the Three Caballeros and
yeah,
Make Mine Music, which mm-hmm. I don't know, Fun and Fancy Free, Melody Time. I don't know that stuff, but yeah. A lot of stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially about $10 a movie. No, $15 a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the bulk of it is, modern times from... Yeah, up to number 50 on here is 2002. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, half of them are from the last 20 years, essentially.
Yeah.
The Monsters movies and Planes, Frozen, Zootopia, Moana, mm-hmm. all that stuff. So, yeah, a lot of good stuff here. Also, if you really want to watch a bunch of this stuff, I don't know if all of this stuff is on Disney Plus, but a lot of it is.
Mm.
So you can check it out that way. But yeah, it comes with original poster designs and additional digital codes for every movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lithograph from Disney's upcoming feature Wish.
Yeah.
Certificate of authenticity and crystal Mickey Mouse ears engraved with the Disney 100 logo.
Mm.
That's at least $20 right there.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go. Pretty much only for the collectors.
Yeah, pretty much. But, yeah, so moving on from there, we have this little bit of news out of Japan. Studio Ghibli is selling a controlling stake to Nippon Television.
Yeah. This doesn't seem like it's a huge deal, but it probably is to a degree. It's sort of Hayao Miyazaki sort of figuring out their succession plan of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
As they say here, as Studio Ghibli director Miyazaki Hayao is now 82 years old and producer Suzuki Toshio is also 75 years old, and the issue of succession has been a problem for a long time. Miyazaki Goro, the eldest son of founder Miyazaki Hayao and an animation film director himself, has been mentioned several times as a successor to Studio Ghibli. However, Miyazaki Goro himself firmly declined, believing that it would be difficult to carry Ghibli alone, mm-hmm. that it would be better to leave the future of the company to others. Mm. Essentially let Nippon Television sort of run things with him probably being a chief creative person there.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been working together for, you know, 30 years or so at this point.
Mm.
So it's sort of a natural thing. But yeah, Nippon Television will be buying shares in Studio Ghibli, become its largest shareholder with 42.3% of voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a big deal there. So yeah, there's sort of a succession plan there for that.
Mm. Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah. Next up, Amazon is planning an ad tier Prime Video. Because of course they are.
Yeah, not really too surprising.
Nope.
I think they are planning to have that be... Let me see how much that's supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're keeping it at the current price for Amazon Prime Video.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want ad-free, it's an additional $3 per month.
Yeah.
For that. Or... I guess $36 for the annual subscription.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the monthly price is a little bit different, but
mm.
Amazon Prime Video is like the video service that you would expect to be like the talk of the town, but nobody gives a shit about most everything they do.
Yeah.
It's like the Lord of the Rings was the first time I've heard like multiple people talk about
mm-hmm.
a thing versus most everything else they do.
Yeah.
Whereas like, and there's like a couple people that already have it for, you know, the shipping and all that.
Yeah.
They just happen to watch every once in a while something like
mm-hmm.
The Boys or Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Yeah.
But like even those don't really get much run time there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they end up spending tons of money on their stuff.
Yeah.
And not really getting the return on it.
Nope.
Other than just getting people into the Amazon ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go for that.
All right. And now we got some trailers and stuff to talk about. We got The Meg 2, The Trench, will be on Max September 29th. That's the movie about the giant shark.
Yeah.
Or at least the sequel to the movie about the giant shark. Most people didn't really see it here, but it was like huge over in China. So
yeah, it's pretty good stuff, especially when you watch, if you watch Jaws, like the Meg makes a lot of sense. It's like, mm-hmm. what's the next evolution of that formula?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what if these were, I'm trying to think what the Meg, like the full name for the Megs are.
Yeah.
But it's like, what if we have a giant shark?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, that works pretty well. What if they're from a weird part of the deep ocean that, you know, explains everything, how they exist? That they're somehow sheltered away from the rest of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, all right. And what if, like, a bunch of them get out of there, and then there's other prehistoric creatures, too?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that sounds dumb.
Yeah.
And it is.
It is very dumb.
So yeah, you can check that out next week.
Well, anyway. And then we have a sequel to Troll, which was that Norwegian movie that turned out to actually be pretty good.
Yeah, from a Norwegian director that has been doing some neat stuff. He did a sort of a disaster movie called The Wave.
Yeah.
That was pretty good, and Troll was also good.
Mm-hmm.
Fun little thing about the myth of the trolls is like the mountains are actual trolls in, you know, in hibernation, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. And yeah, this one wakes up after some mining that's done and wreaks some havoc, and then they deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they're just going to have another one called Troll 2, I guess.
Yep. Though I would hope they give another title, because there's already a Troll 2.
Yeah, but wasn't that not about trolls?
No, but that's not the important part. It's already...
Is that the one with the kid that that reacts in a weird way to the bad guy?
That's the one where the guy's like, they're going to eat her, and then they're going to eat me. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that. No,
that's Troll 2.
Yeah. That's like the kid having the weird dramatic reaction.
Yeah, and the mother being weird as hell.
Yeah.
Like, just extremely weird.
Yeah, so that is a whole thing. Yeah, Troll premiered in 2022, quickly became their most popular non-English film of all time, with 103 million views in its first 91 days, which generally is a pretty good way to get a sequel made.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
Yeah. And then we got an official trailer for Dream Scenario, which is a Nick Cage movie.
Yep. New Nick Cage movie directed and written by Christopher Borgli. Yep. I don't know. Basically, he's like a dude that all of a sudden starts appearing in everybody else's dreams as like a whole thing, and then becomes sort of infamous around this and how that affects him as like a normal dude.
Yeah.
Also one of the few like recent Nick Cage roles where he's not, where he's bald. He's got a nice big bald head there and all that, you know, looking more frumpy than he usually looks in movies. So that's an interesting look for him.
Yeah.
Where I was like, would you actually look like this if you hadn't gotten the hair plugs?
Yeah.
But yeah, this will be out November 10th from A24, so that's neat.
Yep.
Another interesting one from them.
Oh, yeah. So, yep, we got that. And finally, last but not least, we got a teaser trailer for Netflix's Griselda, which is basically, it's a movie inspired by the story of Griselda Blanco, who was this infamous drug runner and drug dealer in Colombia. She was a drug queen pin, I guess you could say. She was one of the most notorious in the country.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Looks pretty good from the teaser we got here, so that's pretty cool. Don't know if they have a date for that yet. January 25th, okay. So early next year.
Yep.
So yeah, that's cool. That'll be a series, so at least a few episodes there.
Yep. Yeah, so with that, I do believe we have got ourselves a show, folks. We have got ourselves a show. So I'd like to remind all of our listeners, if you got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in touch with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for you in our show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch a little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or basically any kind of podcast aggregator you can possibly think of. If you're not on there, just wait a few minutes. We will. We will be. I'm not even going to try and explain it. It's just, we will. You can count on it. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and wind it down here. Thank you, Chris, once again for showing up and helping me in this endeavor. To all those who have been listening, if you like what you heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your casual acquaintances, your mortal enemies, or even just random-ass people you meet on the street, because we're desperate for attention. We're kind of like a newborn puppy that's like realized that it can walk around, and so we're constantly jumping into other people's laps. Like, hey, I'm over here. Hey, pay attention to me. Hey, I'm over here. Yeah, that's us, but in podcast form. But yeah, so with that, we're going to go ahead and tune in next week when we will have a French bash of bullshit to talk about. But until then, I'm going to go back to Skate Free, and we'll probably still be playing it by the time you hear me talk about any shit again next week. But until then, good night, everybody.